Welcome, everybody. I'm Andrew Lanius, and I'm here to introduce, on behalf of both the Federalist Society and the Black Law Students Association, our speakers for today. Thank you very much for coming to this discussion. We are delighted to have you here. Visiting us, we have Hans von Spakovsky, who is a manager in the Election Law Reform Initiative and senior legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation. He received his bachelor's from MIT and his JD from Vanderbilt, and is currently an authority on a wide range of issues, including civil rights, civil justice, the First Amendment, immigration, the rule of law, and government reform. He studies and writes extensively about campaign finance restrictions, voter ID, and civil rights issues. Most recently, he published a book called Who's Counting? How Fraudsters and Bureaucrats Put Your Vote at Risk. Before joining Heritage, he served for 2 years at the Federal Election Commission and worked in the Department of Justice as counsel to the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights. He regularly appears in the Wall Street Journal, Washington Times, Politico, Human Events National Review, Fox News Channel, and on other TV and news outlets. We also have Professor Kim Ford Mazrui, who is the Mortimer M. Kaplan Professor of Law here at UVA. He received his bachelor's summa cum laude from the University of Michigan and his JD magna cum laude also from the University of Michigan, where he was notes editor of the Michigan Law Review. He also won the Henry M. Bates Memorial Scholarship, the highest honor that can be granted by the Michigan Law School. After school, he clerked for the Honorable Cornelia G. Kennedy on the Sixth Circuit and practiced at Sidley and Austin in Washington, D.C. before joining us at UVA in 1996. The classes that he teaches are race in the law, con law, criminal law, employment discrimination, and his scholarship focuses on equal protection, especially with regards to race and sexual orientation. The hallmark of his approach and scholarship is to take seriously the conflicting perspectives on controversial issues and to offer constructive proposals to move society beyond current, often intractable debates. And on a personal note, he was my con law professor, and through that process, he's become a trusted friend, advisor, and mentor to me. And finally, moderating our panel, we have Professor Alex Johnson, who is the James C. Slaughter Professor of Law and Director of the Center for Study of Race in the Law here at UVA Law School. He received his bachelor's from Claremont Men's College and his JD from UCLA. He worked in Los Angeles and taught at the University of Minnesota before joining us. He left the law school in 2012 to become the dean of the University of Minnesota Law School, but he found his way back to us in 2007, where he has been since. His teaching areas include property, modern real estate transactions, trusts and estates, and critical race theory, and his scholarship also focuses in these areas. I could go on mentioning all of the numerous committees and boards that Professor Johnson is on, but I think it will suffice to say that he is a very busy man, and we welcome him, and we welcome all of you. Thank you.
Well, I do appreciate the invitation to be here today to both the Federalist Society and the Black Student Law Association. And I want to say, you know, one of the things the Federalist Society, which I'm a member, is very big about is trying to sponsor a civil debate, which is something that doesn't occur too often these days with the cable news the way it is. But so I want to thank both organizations for inviting us here. Before I start, I did want to tell you, since all of you are law students and you're always looking for summer jobs, that the Heritage Foundation has a very big summer internship program. We hire anywhere between 70 and 80 interns in the summer. Usually four of those are in the legal center where I work. The rest are spread out amongst our different departments working on things from foreign policy to all kinds of domestic policy, national security, et cetera. So if you're interested, you should go to the website and check it out. And we have three big advantages over other Washington, D.C. Internships, especially those in the government and Congress. One, we actually pay. Second, we provide housing to our interns, which is pretty expensive in Washington. And you do real work. Unlike some congressional internships, you're doing real research and going to a lot of different events and functions, particularly with the lawyers, with what I do. Let me start this by saying that I believe that discrimination on the basis of race and race and ethnicity is morally wrong. And I think it's particularly egregious when it is practiced by the government. Now, the 14th Amendment and its Equal Protection Doctrine is supposed to protect us from discriminatory treatment and make sure that all citizens are treated equally under the law. That was also the full intention of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. We're about to come up on its anniversary, which prohibited discrimination in public education, public accommodation, public facilities. There's a host of other federal and state laws in many different areas that prohibit discrimination. But unfortunately, we have had court decisions allowing it, even when it is narrowly tailored, such as the Grutter v. Bollinger decision, which upheld affirmative action at the University of Michigan Law School. Although we should note that Justice O'Connor said that she thought in 25 years it would not longer be necessary. I frankly think the best approach to this is what Chief Justice Roberts said in 2007 in the Seattle schools case, where he said, the way to stop discrimination on the basis of race is to stop discriminating on the basis of race. Now, the term affirmative action, you have to define what you're talking about. That term was first used by President Kennedy in an executive order in which he said that affirmative action must be taken to ensure people are employed, quote, without regard to their race, creed, color, or national origin. Now, I don't have an issue with that original meaning. And in fact, I think it's a good thing for schools and employers and the government to take proactive, positive steps to root out discrimination, prevent its occurrence, and to cast a wide net when recruiting for college or employment. But that is not what affirmative action means today. What it means today is affirmative discrimination. And I think it is not only morally repugnant, but I think it's constitutionally indefensible. The main question you have to face is, do the benefits outweigh the costs? And I think the clear answer is no. Now, what are the two justifications that are given by supporters for this? Well, one is remedial and the other is diversity. Well, remedial, the students today in colleges were born in the 1990s, 30 years after the 1964 Civil Rights Act, and multiple generations after the kind of discrimination that led to that law. That kind of systematic, widespread discrimination is long gone. And those who were hurt by it is similar. You know, Americans today, American students who are punished by racial preferences are people who had nothing to do with what happened 50 years ago. It's as if half the students in this room are being punished under the old English taint of blood crime that was imposed on the families of traitors. And you can't even use that excuse because, of course, the Constitution outlawed bills of attainder and corruption of the blood. Discrimination today against some who had nothing to do with what happened in the past in order to benefit others who have not suffered that discrimination is wrong. And we should all keep in mind that this country actually did something very remarkable. It was an amazing feat that from around the late 1950s to early 1980s, we virtually extinguished race prejudice in a single generation. Yet now we have reinstituted it in our college admissions, public contracting, and employment. The other justification that is given for it is diversity. But that entire concept is based on a racial stereotype. That racial stereotype is that you must think a particular way given what your race or ethnicity is. I mean, I think that is a very racist claim. You want more diversity in college classrooms? Well, then make sure you've got people in those classrooms who are libertarians, Republicans, Democrats, conservatives, liberals, progressives. Then you're going to get diversity of thought in the classroom. You're not going to get it depending on what someone's race is and the idea that they must think a particular way because of what their race is. The costs are great for racial preferences. First of all, it's fundamentally and personally unfair to individuals. It passes over better qualified students and job applicants. It sets a really disturbing legal, political, and moral precedent that some forms of discrimination are acceptable. It creates resentment. It stigmatizes beneficiaries. And what is actually remarkable about this is that there is now a number of empirical studies and evidence that shows that it hurts the supposed beneficiaries. Now, before I go into this, I should tell you, the American people actually agree with my position on this. The Washington Post, ABC, did a poll last year, you know, ABC, Washington Post, not exactly conservative news sources, in which they found that 76% of Americans opposed race-based college admissions. That's 8 in 10 whites, 8 in 10 blacks, and 7 in 10 Hispanics. A Gallup poll found the same thing. Two-thirds of all Americans oppose racial preferences. Now, what is this empirical evidence? This empirical evidence, when you hear it, it's just common sense. And you would think it's common sense, except for the fact that race is involved. What racial preferences and college admissions cause is what's called the mismatch problem. And if you want to get a full explanation of this, I would urge you to do something, and that is go to SCOTUS blog. You all know that blog. It lists all the Supreme Court cases. Go to SCOTUS blog and look up the Fisher versus University of Texas Austin case. And go in there and find the two amicus briefs that were filed. One was filed by three commissioners from the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, Gail Harriet, Peter Kersenow, and Todd Gaziano. And another amicus brief was filed by Stuart Taylor and Richard Sander, who is a law school professor at UCLA. The Civil Rights commissioners filed an amicus brief in which they went through all the empirical studies that have been done, and here's what they found. Students who attend schools where they're entering academic credentials, put them in the bottom of the class, are less likely to follow through than similarly credentialed students who attend schools where their credentials put them in the middle or top of the class. The second amicus brief talks about studies regarding law schools. And what did they find? That students, regardless of race, are less likely to graduate and pass the bar if they are beneficiaries of preferential treatment in admissions than if they attend a law school at which their credentials match that of other entering students. Look, this is pretty obvious. And I can tell you, this certainly happened to me when I went to MIT under the mistaken impression I wanted to be an engineer. Look, if you are in a class, and this can happen to anybody, race has nothing to do with it. If you're in a class where the other students are academically ahead of you, you're going to have problems. You're going to have problems getting a good grade. You're going to get frustrated more easily. And in fact, that's what happens with students who get into schools because of racial preferences. There's actually a study done by two University of Virginia psychologists. I'd urge you to read it. It's from 2004, and here's a quote from it. Race-sensitive admission, while increasing access to elite colleges, was inadvertently causing disproportionate loss of talented, underrepresented minority students from science majors. They created a model to see how many more students would have graduated with science and engineering majors if they had been admitted at schools where their credentials matched the rest of the classes. For women, it was an increase of 45%. For men, an increase of 35%. Another study from the Mellon Foundation found that top African-American students admitted to elite schools where their SAT scores were 200 points below white students, which was virtually the same at all these selective schools. The African-American students ended up in the lower quarter of their class. They had less academic self-confidence, less persistence, and much lower graduation rates. The point here, again, as I said, it's not race. It's people getting into schools where they don't match the credentials of the other students. And the problem here, the mismatch problem, is this. The top-tier schools can't meet their demand for minority students. So they allow students in with less academic credentials, lower test scores, than the other folks in their class. The second-tier schools have the same problem because all the kids who ought to be going to the second-tier schools where they would fit right in with the other students have been accepted at the first-tier schools. So the second-tier schools are taking kids who should be in third-tier schools, and it goes all the way up and down. Now, it's not that these kids are bad students. They might be honor students if they were at a school where their credentials match that of other students. Now, what happened in California, which was one of the first states to pass a proposition, Proposition 209, that said that all schools, universities in the state could not use racial preferences in their admissions. Quote, minority graduation rates increased after Proposition 209 was implemented. Also, while the number of minority students dropped at some of the top schools, they spread out to the lower schools so that today, system-wide, the absolute number of Hispanics and blacks in the California system has substantially increased, and that includes when you look at the metrics relative to state population share. In fact, black and Hispanic enrollments at the University of California are now higher than before Proposition 209. And what happened to the graduation rates after this proposition went in? Before racial preferences were banned, only 17% of black students entering in the 1992 graduated in 4 years. In 2007, 45% of those entering graduated in 4 years. There were similar improvements for Hispanic students. So you had almost a doubling of the graduation rates of these students. Also, what was interesting was they took a look at high school students in California and what happened after this proposition went in. And you know what they found? They found that the number of black California students in the top 10% academically throughout the state jumped by more than a third after Proposition 209, and it has continued to rise. Now, some people say, well, this decreases diversity in the college systems. You know what they found in California? Look, the top schools in the UC system were Berkeley and UCLA. Prior to this proposition, they used very large racial preferences to compete aggressively with the less elite campuses throughout the system. So they ended up getting about half of the black students enrolling in the UC system. Were only those two schools. After Proposition 209, black students became more evenly distributed across all 8 campuses of the UC system. So actually, they had better diversity after this went in. Now, I'll tell you, look, it's not just, I'm a conservative, I make no apologies about that. It's not just conservatives who are talking about the failures of affirmative action. Take a look just a couple of days ago, February 2nd, in Slate magazine, which is not exactly an organ of the vast right-wing conspiracy, there's an article by a guy named Tanner Colby, and it's entitled, "The Massive Liberal Failure on Race. Affirmative action doesn't work. It never did. It's time for a new solution." Now, back in 1976, Stanley Mosk, who was a liberal icon of the California Supreme Court, said in the Bakke decision, quote, "To uphold the university would call for the sacrifice of principle for the sake of dubious expediency and would represent a retreat in the struggle to assure that each man and woman shall be judged on the basis of individual merit alone." I think that is exactly the approach we should be taking. Unfortunately, his view did not prevail, but I hope that it will in the future. Thanks.
By the way, for those seated on the floor, there are plenty of seats up front. Okay, I brought a little timer because I cannot see the clock. Okay, thank you all for being here. Thank you, Mr. Spakovsky, for coming. Thank you to BALSA, and thank you for the Federalist Society for this event. Indeed, I want to take the opportunity to use my remarks to honor the Federalist Society. And what I'm calling my remarks today are Taking the Federalist Society Seriously, a constitutional defense of affirmative action. I want to make 3 points. One, Federalist Society principles for interpreting the Constitution support the constitutionality of race-based affirmative action. Second, less conservative methods of interpreting the Constitution but are nonetheless widely accepted by significant portions of our judiciary also support the constitutionality of race-based affirmative action. And finally, morality supports race-based affirmative action, although by that point, the Federalist Society would hold that that's an impermissible role for the judiciary to play. But nonetheless, even under that approach, it should be upheld. So why should the Federalist Society support the constitutionality of affirmative action? Because the Federalist Society, as our guest speaker indicated, believes in principled approaches to the Constitution. Federalist Society is known for advocating that the law, courts should adjudicate what the law is, not what it should be. That is to say, good laws versus bad laws is not the question. It's whether the Constitution prevents the political process from enacting the law. And Federalist Society holds to text, originalism, to some degree, traditionalism, as the exclusive modes for interpreting the Constitution to avoid legislating from the bench. The Federalist Society believes in a healthy respect for judicial restraint, respect for state sovereignty, and respect for the democratic process. And these principles support affirmative action. And let me mention as an illustration of a principled approach, my colleague John Harrison, a supporter of the Federalist Society, who has said in writing, which is a courageous thing to say, that if originalism does not support the outcome in Brown versus Board of Education, that doesn't mean originalism is wrong. The Constitution can allow bad results. If you interpret it according to the original meaning, sometimes that means later we decide that was a poor policy, but if that's what the Constitution allows, you amend the Constitution, as the Federalist Society knows, or you enact legislation to address the problem. Similarly, originalism and textualism and traditionalism, etc., as I will argue, support the constitutionality of affirmative action, and the Federalist Society should stand up for its principles, even if many of its members think affirmative action is bad and unwise policy. The text. The Constitution guarantees equality. It's a conceptual mistake to think that equality means treating people identically the same. If that were the case, we wouldn't have law schools because virtually every law discriminates and treats people differently. What equality guarantees is that the difference in treatment be justified by legitimate reasons. Equality requires treating similarly situated people similarly, but equality not only allows, but requires treating differently situated people differently. And the term equality gives no indication as to what the criteria are for determining what legitimate reasons are. And the Federalist Society knows that, and that's why they say when the Constitution is ambiguous, before we default to the political process, which is the normal approach, if the Constitution doesn't speak to it, let the democratic process work it out, unless the original meaning of the Constitution gives us an answer. But again, the burden is on the challenger to show that the original meaning of an ambiguous term precludes the political process from addressing the problem, and with respect to affirmative action, there just is not a persuasive case. Here are just a few reasons why I say that. First of all, the ratification surrounding the Equal Protection Clause did not focus at all on affirmative action. It didn't even focus much on primary education, as you know from studying Brown versus Board of Education. Moreover, the 39th Congress enacted laws like the Freedmen's Bureau and laws in Washington, D.C., designed explicitly to provide aid to destitute colored women that were purposely designed to benefit African Americans. The 1866 Act, on which the 14th Amendment was based and designed to ratify, was purposely focused on aspects of civic and life that did not include education. The right to contract, the right to own property, the right to sue and be sued. But education and interracial marriage were left out. The framers of the 14th Amendment thought race-conscious discrimination in education and marriage were not touched by the Equal Protection Clause. Final evidence for what Congress thought is Congress funded affirmative action. Congress provided land grants to states to fund the creation of schools of higher education that included schools with racial quotas, schools that 100% of the students had to be white. And Congress funded with the knowledge and intent that these kinds of schools would be built with the money. And also, some of the money was built to produce historically black colleges. But of course, the best schools with Congress's funding were limited to whites. And state practice, another evidence of original meaning, as I've just mentioned, states reserved their best schools of higher education and the great majority of those schools to whites. And the final reason that the original meaning does not preclude the political process in states from experimenting with affirmative action that I point to are Justices Scalia and Justice Thomas, two friends of the Federalist Society, who make no serious originalist case against affirmative action. Scalia has been arguing that affirmative action is unconstitutional for 25 years. In that amount of time, he could have had the research done to make an originalist case. He doesn't. He doesn't at all, in any kind of persuasive way. So, originalism, textualism don't provide an answer, indeed suggest the opposite. So, the Federalist Society would say, courts, stay out of it. You don't have a basis to interfere. What about traditionalism? Well, not all Federalist Society adherents would agree that traditionalism is justified, meaning even if original meaning doesn't speak to it, perhaps a deeply rooted tradition can develop over time. But sometimes Scalia gives a nod to traditionalism, Thomas tends not to. But even if we look to traditionalism, Scalia would emphasize it has to be deeply rooted. There's no deeply rooted tradition against affirmative action. Contemporary affirmative action didn't exist until the late 1960s and 1970s. That's not enough to make a deeply rooted tradition of it existing, let alone a tradition against it. Moreover, the great majority of states allow affirmative action. I think 42, the federal government has affirmative action. The Supreme Court in Bakke and Grutter upheld affirmative action. So there is not a deeply rooted tradition against affirmative action. Turning to less conservative, but nonetheless methodologies that that we accept to some degree in our legal culture, political process theory, the most famous version of which is that of John Hart Ely, but you also see it in Supreme Court cases. Croson mentions it. Caroline Products footnote 4, as you're well aware, says we should defer to the political process, take it up with your elected officials. If you don't like something, don't run to the courts. Unless, Caroline Products footnote 4, we'll make an exception if it burdens a discrete and insular minority. White people are not a discrete and insular minority. If so, everybody is, and you should just go to court whenever every piece of legislation is passed. So political process theory does not justify interfering with affirmative action, and that theory itself may be cut loose from what Federalist Society principles support. And finally, evolving national consensus, like Lawrence versus Texas, where the majority says there's an emerging awareness. Scalia calls that an oxymoron, an emerging tradition of adult private sexuality, but no serious attempt at even trying to justify constitutional methodology by evolving consensus would just go to opinion polls. They wouldn't just say, we're taking a poll, is abortion legal, is gun rights legal, is prayer in schools legal? Those who adhere to evolving national consensus, and Federalist Society does not, look to objective evidence like state practices, cleaning up the outliers, like in Griswold versus Connecticut, the last couple of states that have not allowed contraception. There's no consensus that affirmative action is unconstitutional. Indeed, it's one of the most divisive issues in the country. And only 8 states have banned it. If that makes a consensus, all sorts of things should be constitutionalized. More than twice as many states have ratified same-sex marriage. I doubt the Federalist Society, certainly Scalia and Thomas, would not think that that makes same-sex marriage constitutionally protected. So the third claim is turning to morality, but again, at this point, the Federalist Society would say, look, that's the wrong way to go. Judges should not moralize from the bench. So at this point, their case has rested. So if you adhere to Federalist Society principles, I can sit down. But for those who believe in moralizing for the bench, oddly, Scalia does this in Richmond versus Croson. Rather than citing originalism, he cites a scholar, Alexander Bickel, that says race discrimination is immoral. That's his justification. But so if we get into the moral case, which again, now we're not really talking constitutional law, we're talking policy. But let me suggest why, on balance, it should be allowed. The case for affirmative action rests on 3 principles. The constitutionality of affirmative action. 1, discrimination is wrong. 2, corrective justice, that a wrong should be righted. And that's not some fancy theory. That's in your torts and criminal law and contract law. Okay, that's my little 3-minute warning. Okay. This is every right implies a remedy, Marbury versus Bannon. So corrective justice theory is pervasive to our law and most countries on earth. And 3rd, that race is necessary to rectify race discrimination. Applied to justifying affirmative action, the claim is that the discrimination that was intergenerational and systemic for hundreds of years against African Americans was wrong, as our guest speaker agrees. The effects of that discrimination are also pervasive across virtually every indicator of social and economic well-being. African Americans are significantly worse off than whites, and that those disparities have persisted since well before the civil rights movement. It's simply implausible to claim that those are not significantly caused by the discrimination that officially existed in this country until roughly 1970. Corrective justice means society owes an obligation to remedy it, just as we did with the Japanese Americans who were interned. And 3rdly, race is necessary. You simply can't as effectively identify the victims, intergenerational victims. Some are victims of discrimination today. Some are victims by inheriting economic and educational disadvantage through their parents. It can go intergenerationally. That's what explains the stark disparities. No alternative than using race could adequately identify the people who were discriminated against or inherited the effects of discrimination because of race. So that's the moral case. There's an egregious wrong. You need corrective justice, and race is necessary. And Federalist Society agrees with all 3 principles because that's the case against affirmative action. Abigail Fisher, Barbara Grutter, Jennifer Gratz, they say affirmative action is wrong. Discrimination is wrong. They say it's a form of discrimination. I don't dispute that it's a form of discrimination. Corrective justice, I want my day in court. If I prove I was a victim of affirmative action, I don't want you to say, okay, we agree. I want you to do something about it. Admit me to the school. Give me monetary damages. Issue an injunction. So they want corrective justice. And race is necessary to the claims against affirmative action. Abigail Fisher, Barbara Grutter, a necessary element of their complaint is that they're Caucasian. In fact, Barbara Grutter's suit against the University of Michigan Law School says, on behalf of a class of Caucasians that were denied admission because of race. So notice, it uses race. It says, pay attention to my race. And it's a group-based claim. So we have a bit of a moral dilemma here. I've said there's a moral case for, but affirmative action, they make a moral case against. So what do? We have two wrongs to balance? Well, first of all, I emphasize that's hardly a constitutional question. That's a political cost-benefit analysis question. What's the pros and cons? Which is worse? How do we deal with it? How do we manage the different costs and benefits? But I'll suggest that on balance, remedying historic discrimination is morally more justified, mainly because of the purpose and the effect. The purpose behind discrimination and segregation was invidious. It was based on racial supremacy. It was based on hatred. The discrimination involved in affirmative action is not of such an ugly sort. Now, that's not to say it's you can't object to it, but no one seriously thinks that it's of the same ugly, hateful nature. If so, it's surprising how many white people support it. I don't think there's that much self-hatred. Secondly, the effect. The effect of discrimination and the reason that it remains such a racially divided country along economic lines is, again, because it was systematic across all aspects of life, education, housing, economic opportunity, and it was intergenerational. So it created an underclass identifiable by race. So you lift the official restrictions, you've already created poor communities identifiable by race. That then tends to perpetuate itself from one generation to the next. Affirmative action doesn't have that same systematic effect. If someone is turned down from their school like Michigan or Texas or Virginia because of affirmative action, they're not now relegated to menial labor. They're relegated to their second choice school. And typically it's similar or not too far down the chain. And their life chances are still largely the same, and next generation is unlikely to experience any significant difference. So in terms of weighing the competing wrongs, again, that's not really something that courts should be doing anyway, but if they were, affirmative action wins out. But to return to the Federalist Society principles, text, originalism, traditionalism, judicial restraint, respect for state sovereignty, respect for the democratic process. If we take the Federalist Society seriously, affirmative action is constitutional. Thank you very much.